remember once walking out of the courtroom after my client had been acquitted of an armed robbery, and he said, you're pretty good. You should go to law school. And I said, what makes you think I didn't go to law school? Well, you're a public defender.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to the Actual Innocence Podcast, a podcast to help bring awareness to those who have been wrongfully convicted. This episode will introduce you to the University of Baltimore Innocence Clinic in the state of Maryland. It was such an interesting experience visiting this location. It was really different from the other Innocence Network agencies that I'd visited before. This episode is being brought to you by three sponsors, Talkspace, Spring, and Framebridge. I appreciate everyone's support of our sponsors. It helps me to bring you more episodes and keeps me from living in my car. I'm not sure if it's just me or the weather or what, but it seems like there's a lot of folks around that are feeling a bit stressed out lately. And that's why I'm excited to introduce our new sponsor this week, Talkspace. If you've ever thought about going to therapy, but found it too inconvenient, too expensive, or just too embarrassing to make it into an office, then give Talkspace a try. Talkspace is the online therapy company, and it makes it easy to connect with a licensed therapist, handpicked just for you, for as little as $32 a week. Using Talkspace, you can text, audio, and video message your therapist as much as you want. Your Talkspace therapist can listen to you vent about work or family, explore your relationships with the people around you, and help put you on a path to a happier life. To sign up or to learn more, go to Talkspace.com/actual. And as a special offer to our listeners, you can use the coupon code ACTUAL to get $30 off your first month and show your support for this podcast. That's ACTUAL. And Talkspace.com/actual. Talkspace, therapy for how we live today. I've spent the better part of this week in Maryland for work on my new project. Just today, I was able to visit with the University of Baltimore Innocence Clinic. I had so much fun, and it was such an enlightening experience speaking with Michelle and Tawanda about their experiences.
My name is Michelle Nethercott, and I'm the director of the University of Baltimore Innocence Project Clinic.
My name is Tawanda Luckett, and I am paralegal with the University of Baltimore Innocence Project.
How does an inmate become one of your clients?
Well, there are different ways. The most typical is they write a letter and ask for help, and assuming that in the letter they aren't saying something that makes them obviously ineligible for our services, which sometimes people do, because we don't take cases that involve issues of degrees of culpability. In other words, we don't take a not guilty of first degree murder, it was really a manslaughter. We don't take those kind of cases. So typically, the process begins with someone writing a letter. They're then asked to fill out a lengthy questionnaire providing a lot of information about the case. That's reviewed. This is kind of like think of it as sort of a big funnel. The letter comes, and then the next thing that gets examined is the responses to the questionnaire. If nothing in that process, makes it clear that the case is just not appropriate, we then begin the process of collecting documents. And that means collecting basically just about anything we can get our hands on that has any relationship to the case. So that includes the contents of court files, transcripts of proceedings. That means obviously the transcript of the trial, transcripts of any motions, of any post-conviction hearings that they may have had. And then we attempt to get investigative reports, crime lab reports, any sort of investigative reports related to the case, and we examine them. So it's a very labor-intensive and time-consuming process. And one of the biggest frustrations is the difficulty and the length of time and often the expense that's incurred in trying to get those documents. But they're key, because very often, I would say the vast majority of cases where we've had success, or even where we've identified information that supports the person's claim that they didn't commit the crime, it's typically in those investigative files. So it's absolutely critical that we obtain them, but the process is quite difficult. Not even finished. So once you have obtained all of that information and it appears that there may be, you know, this may be a valid factual innocence claim, you know, there's lengthy meetings with the person who was convicted based on information that may emerge from that interview and from the review of the investigative files. Often there's additional factual investigation, going out and, you know, finding witnesses, tracking them down, interviewing them. So the longest part of the process really is this acquiring investigative materials. Sometimes it can be a lengthy process to obtain the court materials as well. And at the end of that whole process of fact gathering, then you have to look at it and see if anything you have uncovered that supports the innocence claim, that for whatever reason was never presented to the original fact finder, is something that under Maryland law, Maryland state law, there's any way of getting relief for the person. Because you can be factually innocent and completely out of luck in terms of any sort of procedural mechanism to get your conviction reviewed again. So that's, I guess, the next major phase of the case. And at that point, if that review suggests, at least in my judgment, that there's validity to the claim and something that we can work with legally, and then we make a determination to represent the person, and then we start filing pleadings and litigating the case, or maybe not litigating the case if we can persuade the prosecutor that we have a valid claim of factual innocence and that they should not oppose us.
So I see two other people in this room. Who does all that work?
You see two people in this, me and mm-hmm. Yes, that's us.
You do all the steps?
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, more recently, we've actually entered into a memorandum of understanding with an affiliated project in D.C. called the Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project. And we've moved towards consolidation of intake, and we're working towards some integration of our operations because we both are facing increasing demand for our services and declining revenues with which to support the work. Much of this work, at least for the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, much of it has been grant funded, and those federal grants, which I have relied on pretty much exclusively for the last 8 years to pay for DNA testing, are becoming, you know, the amount of funds that Congress is appropriating has been declining.
Did you say how long have you done this?
I've actually been doing this Innocence Project work since 2002.
How long have you done it?
2011. Yes.
So, do you need volunteers? Like, do you accept volunteers?
Well, at the moment, that's, quite honestly, that's sort of difficult right now because we're in a transition phase. We're working on trying to work out some integration of our operations with the Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project. And you really, for this kind of work, you really need to have a sort of infrastructure in place to, you know, monitor, screen volunteers. We just really aren't at that point right now. I know it's sometimes sounds frustrating to people because they don't understand why, you know, they can't just sort of drop in and volunteer, but it can be very difficult in this kind of work. You really have to have a pretty, at least in my judgment, you really need a very formal structure that can train volunteers and monitor, supervise them, and I don't have the staff to do that.
What made you want to work for the Innocence Project?
I started my legal career as a public defender, as a trial public defender who tried felonies and misdemeanors and juvenile cases. And I guess there's just something strange about me, but I always found that I often found myself in disagreement not only with prosecutors who seemed, you know, completely convinced of a particular client's guilt, but I often found myself in conflict with even my colleagues. And I remember after a few years of doing trial work, I remember once thinking, you know, if I had to give up all the procedural rights that we hear about, that usually in the form of complaints, that, oh my God, these defendants, they have so many rights, you know. If I could give up the all of these, you know, alleged procedural rights that we honor sometimes in the breach, would I exchange that for a more reliable fact-finding process? And I kind of always felt like that might not be a bad deal for a lot of our clients. But anyway, I guess what I'm really trying to say is that in the course of litigating cases at the trial level, I just saw many instances in which I just did not share others' confidence in the validity of the evidence. And I developed a particular interest in forensic, so-called scientific evidence. And although I think I was kind of a voice in the wilderness for a long time, I think recent events have vindicated some of the concerns I had at that time about how so-called scientific evidence was actually being badly misused in the criminal prosecution and in the criminal trial process. And it's actually continues to be occurring today, although I think there's a little more awareness about the nature of the problem because, well, for a variety of reasons, but it still is a problem today.
So what made you want to start here?
So I was actually a paralegal with the Baltimore City State's Attorney's office before I applied for this position. And surprisingly, it was an assistant state's attorney that told me about the University of Baltimore Innocence Project. And I found out that there was a position available. I applied, and Ms. Nethercott hired me in December of 2010. And I brought my investigative skills here. So, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful ride. I could not have imagined that I would be fulfilled in my work life to this extent. It really has been amazing.
What's your typical day look like? If there is one.
There really isn't a typical day. For the most part, it's really just a continuation of whatever I'm working on a specific case, like she mentioned to you about the obtaining of files and following up, making sure that people are actually honoring our requests. That's what the majority of my day is like. And then there are some days where just chaos erupts and I'm assisting Ms. Nethercott in dealing with a number of crises. So it really isn't a typical day, but for the most part, I spend my days trying to get people to do their jobs, as in, if we request something and we have done everything that we're supposed to do, please give us the documents.
Right.
It takes up a lot of time.
Have you ever found someone that you thought was innocent, but there was no way to get them back in court?
Yes.
Yeah. That's hard, right? Like, it makes me sad just
Yeah.
Well, is there something that you think sets this project apart from the other ones? What's different in Maryland?
So, Ms. Nethercott admittedly is, she is not a person that is about the limelight. And it is crazy for as successful as she is in her work. She is genuinely about the work. Like, if she gets accolades, that's just a cherry on top for her. And even still, she doesn't care about that stuff. And I think that when you're doing this type of work, I've seen that if the person cares, genuinely cares, it matters in the outcome. I mean, I have seen her take a case that looks like it's just a mess. Like, why are you even becoming involved in this? And the next thing you know, we're in front of a judge and they are, you know, ruling in her favor. So I think that it matters. And she sees things that people that have the same amount or even more experience than her, as far as being a trial attorney, don't see. And I think that's amazing. I think just because she gets it, like, she reads like a maniac. She really does. Like, I mean, if a scientific breakthrough came out last week, she probably knows more than those people already. And I just think that when you say what sets the projects apart, not that all aren't doing great work, but people that are invested in the outcome make all the difference. And she is. I don't think that you could ever speak to one of her clients and ask them about her and that they would say anything other than she works.
That's amazing.
She does. She really does.
Well, thank you. I was taking that question in kind of a different spirit of this. Well, this project is unique in that it's certainly in the minoritarian position in terms of its structure. That basically what we have seen over the years is there's a number of innocence projects that are based in law schools. Mm-hmm. Then there are some that function as nonprofits. There are a few, and this is of more recent vintage, that are actually based in, housed in public defender offices. This project is actually a collaborative project in which the Office of the Public Defender provides resources, the University of Baltimore Law School provides resources, the University of Baltimore itself provides a lot of assistance with the infrastructure around grant submission, particularly federal grants. If you've ever had experience with federal grants, it's very time consuming, and you really have to have the knowledge base to be successful at getting the grants, and you have to really be careful about monitoring them so you don't get into any sort of, you know, financial problems or performance-related problems with federal grant money. So I think it's somewhat unique in that configuration of a public defender and a law school and a university all. I have sometimes more memorandums of understanding with entities than I can keep track of between the grants and, but, so I think it's that structure is different. The other thing that's different about us, obviously, is that, you know, we practice in Maryland state courts. Mm-hmm. And so our successes and our failures are, to a large extent, a function of the legal landscape in the Maryland state courts. I don't know that doesn't really make us, in and of itself, doesn't make us different from other projects as a species, but,
right,
you know, what we are able to do or not do is a function of our law. I mean, some states have extremely restrictive DNA testing statutes. Maryland has historically a pretty liberal statute as far as obtaining testing. Unfortunately, that situation changed somewhat in the last year when our Court of Appeals decided that someone who had been convicted as a result of a plea, whether that was an Alford plea or a guilty plea, could not seek post-conviction DNA testing. You know, because we've had historically a pretty liberal testing statute, we've been able to do probably, I would suspect, more DNA testing than other projects. We've also, because we've been pretty successful at getting the federal grants to do it, we've also been able to afford to do the testing.
Does Maryland have, like, a compensation statute?
Yes, it does. And this is how it works. You can apply to the Board of Public Works for compensation. It is not like other states where there's some kind of formula. It's not like, oh, you get X amount of dollars for X amount of years. However, you can't do that. You can't request that from the Board of Public Works until you have received from the governor a pardon that states the governor is pardoning you on the basis of the governor concluding that you were innocent of the crime of which you were convicted.
Even if you were exonerated, he has to...
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So that, as you can imagine, is a problem. It's a problem because it creates a huge bureaucratic hurdle. It makes the process subject to both the political forces that may be in play, and to some degree, it's a function of the individual whims of the governor, because the governor can act promptly on that request, not act on it at all, or act negatively, and there's absolutely no standards governing, you know, what that process entails. And it's changed, you know, from governor to governor, what the process is. So there are actually efforts underway. Maryland has a legislative session that begins in January and ends in April. There's actually legislation pending this year to try and ameliorate this situation as far as the compensation aspect is concerned. I don't know. We're not at the end of the session yet, so stay tuned. I don't know how that's going to fare in the legislature. But that's our compensation scheme.
That blows my mind.
Not a whole lot of people have gotten compensated.
Feels unreal to me that, you know, no, you're not guilty, but you're...
One other problem is that the statute also says that if you're represented by an attorney in this whole process, which it's really hard to imagine how you would ever get anywhere if you weren't represented by an attorney, the attorney cannot receive any compensation from an award. So, as a practical matter, that means the person has to find an attorney who's going to do this without compensation. Or, I suppose, theoretically, if somehow you had money, you could retain them and pay them an hourly rate, but I don't have any exonerated clients who find themselves in that kind of financial situation.
Do you have an aha moment, like a moment that is like, wow, this is why I do this?
Yes, I think as I said to you when I met you today I'm having the reverse aha moment, because a client that I represented for years fought for years and years to get DNA testing that ultimately exonerated him of a murder that he served 17 years in prison for, died yesterday. He got out in May. And so I sort of, it's interesting you asked that question, because today I'm struggling with feeling kind of discouraged. But do I have aha moments? Well, I certainly have aha moments in cases,
right?
Where I guess it's the suppressed detective in me. I have a lot of those.
Oh, I get that.
I have a lot of those aha moments where it's like, oh, that's what happened.
Right.
You know, very often the process of reinvestigation can give you some pretty good working theories on who actually committed this crime. So I guess that part of the work has some appeal. Just on that level, it's interesting.
How many people have been exonerated?
I can go from when I started.
But put it this way, I think since 2002, it's
five. Moni.
It's come close to averaging about one a year.
Okay. How does it feel like when someone gets exonerated? I mean,
well, that's a good day. that's a great day.
I need to take a minute to talk about our sponsors. Like most of us on a budget, I love finding the best deals online, and that's part of the reason that I love spring so much. Plus, it's convenient finding all my favorite brands in the same place. Spring is a digital shopping destination for over 1,500 brands for fashion, beauty, and lifestyle needs in one place. Not having to visit multiple stores is definitely a bonus for me. Some of the brands you might find include Origins, Smashbox, and Urban Outfitters. From those wardrobe staples to shoes and accessories, tech and travel gear, and luxury brands, you'll find all the must-haves at shopspring.com. Plus, no shipping minimum. Download the Spring app in the App Store or go to shopspring.com now to start saving on all the latest fashions and lifestyle trends. Get free shipping and free returns on your Spring purchases with no spending minimum. And as an added bonus, use my code ACTUAL at checkout to take 20% off your first purchase. And you can see the website for more details. That's shopspring.com or shop through the Spring app and use my code ACTUAL. I just moved this weekend and I've been on a decorating frenzy. My walls are bare and I have a million pictures trapped in my phone. Thank goodness I use Framebridge because I know I can order them now and by the time I get home from my trip, they'll already be waiting for me at the door. Framebridge is so easy to use. Just go to framebridge.com and follow the simple instructions. It took me less than 5 minutes. Plus, I had my degree framed, and shipping was free both ways, and it was lightning fast. Plus, it didn't cost as much as my college education. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order at framebridge.com just by using my code, ACTUAL. They have so many styles, from clean and classic to more eccentric styles. Plus, they use premium wood moldings and other high-quality materials, so I know that my pieces are going to last a very long time. I especially love their happiness guarantee, so I know that no matter what, I'll be satisfied with my order. Get started today, framing your photos or art by going to framebridge.com and use promo code ACTUAL to save an additional 15% on your first order. Just go to framebridge.com, promo code ACTUAL. One more time, framebridge.com, promo code ACTUAL.
Do you have an aha moment? Like one that you're like, man, I'm just going to remember that forever because it was just so amazing.
We had a client whose case we were working on. How do you explain that release?
Well, we represented a man who had been convicted of a murder in Baltimore City State Court. He always emphatically denied having any involvement in this murder. And after he was convicted, this is a very complicated story, but suffice it to say, by coincidence, the federal government ended up investigating a case that involved, they began investigating a man by the name of Jose Morales, who, as it turns out, was the person who ordered this killing. Jose Morales was arrested in Texas with a large quantity of cocaine trying to charter a flight. And when he was interviewed by federal officials, he implicated an attorney, criminal defense attorney in Baltimore City, who he alleged was an active co-conspirator in his, at least one of his criminal enterprises that involved drug dealing and money laundering, so on and so forth. So anyway, the feds do not believe this. And in fact, when he goes to sentencing on this drug matter down in Texas,
Jose
Morales, the judge says, in passing sentence on him, says, you know, and these ridiculous allegations about this attorney, just make it even clearer to me how, you know, what a bad actor you are. Now, interestingly, the local federal authorities, apparently, for whatever reason, they were not as dismissive. And one thing led to another, and one day, and I do remember this because it was quite a big sort of shockwaves through the legal community, this attorney ends up arrested because he has a lot of cash in his house, and he's got this log, and He had served as Jose Morales' attorney.
Oh, wow.
And so the federal government becomes involved in... So then Jose Morales, he ends up in federal prison on this drug charge. While he's doing time on that, he gets all mixed up in another drug conspiracy involving drugs coming into the prison. So he becomes the subject of, you know, another federal investigation. And in the course of doing this investigation, the federal government learns that he was the one who had the victim of this murder killed because the victim was scheduled to testify against Jose Morales in Baltimore City court. Anyway, the federal government found out that it was Jose Morales who had hired another individual to do this murder. Jose Morales did not know, had never, as far as we know, even come in contact with my client, who now comes into the picture. You may say to yourself, how in the world did Demetrius Smith end up convicted of this murder? That's going to be a question for the ages, because from the time of the initial investigation, the family of Robert Long, the victim, was saying to the police, the local Baltimore City homicide detectives, Jose Morales did this, because they knew that he was being threatened, and because he was voicing his concern about what, you know, Jose, yes,
oh my gosh,
Jose was going to do to him. Curiously, that lead is just not pursued. And instead, sometime after this, a woman by the name of Maria Moses, who herself had rather checkered past with some prior drug convictions. But anyway, she fancied herself what did she call herself? She was sort of a neighborhood watch person. She had a row house that had all these cameras and recorders on like all the walls. And in addition to being this community sort of crime watch center, she fancied herself, and in fact apparently not only fancied herself, but actually operated as a informant broker, right? So you may laugh, but people would come to her and say, you know, this, that, and the other, and this is according to her description, and then she would go to the police and kind of broker, you know, make sure they got taken care of and the police got this information. And she apparently had a whole log book, which she never actually would share that with us. But so somehow Maria Moses, she gets involved, and this man, Mark Bartlett, who was a guy who lived in the neighborhood, who had a terrible drug problem. And sometime prior to this murder happening, he got into some fight with my client over, according to my client, because he was always stealing things. Anyway, Mark Bartlett is picked up again on a violation of probation warrant, and all of a sudden he has this information.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the phone booth adjacent to the park where the murder happened, and he saw the whole thing go down, and he identifies my client. And then some more time goes by, and eventually another individual who also had a serious drug problem that relevance of that hopefully becomes apparent shortly, who also was deaf, says, yes, she saw the whole thing. And so both of them ultimately select my client's photo out of a photo array, and they then identify him at trial, and on that basis, he's convicted. Now, one big problem with what both of these witnesses say is that, like so many areas of Baltimore, there's actually a police CCTV camera posted on a light pole right across from the park, and it pans around so you can see the phone booth, the park. And when I finally was able to retrieve that actual film and review it, and the U.S. attorney reviewed it, as I believe, at some point, they're nowhere to be found.
Oh my God.
They're not at that phone booth. And anyway, to make a long story short, it was essentially as a result of the information that came out of this federal investigation, which then became a federal prosecution of Jose Morales, creating this situation that was difficult for the government, because here they are prosecuting Jose Morales on a completely different theory, for which they had a lot of evidence, you know, cell phone records and statements and witnesses, but it was completely at variance with the entire theory behind the prosecution of Demetrius Smith. And so they became involved in facilitating the production of this evidence. And eventually, the state's attorney agreed not to oppose a new trial motion. And he was granted a new trial. So how does Maria Moses come into this? Well, Maria Moses, I guess on the say-so of her informant, had decided that a terrible injustice had resulted from Demetrius escaping, the appropriate consequences for this crime that she was convinced, of course, that he had committed. And so after Demetrius got out, he was being interviewed by a Baltimore Sun reporter one day. I did not know this. Apparently, the reporter had decided to do a part of this interview, I guess, in the park where the murder had happened, which is a few blocks from where Maria Moses lives. And we were there trying to, talk to Maria Moses about this logbook that she kept referring to and at some point said she would produce.
Yes.
So you were sitting in a car with her, and
yes,
she was going on and on and on about
how she was out, what she claimed to be outside at the time that certain incidents had occurred, and she watched him commit these acts. And I'm sitting in the car with her, and up the street walks Demetrius,
who's very distinctive looking, because he has a very, how would you describe it, a very sort of solid, bulky build.
Yeah, very stocky, yeah.
Really
don't stupid. Mistake him for anybody
okay.
else. So I'm sitting in the car, and mind you, she's just told me all these things about him, and he comes walking up the street. Now, I have no idea. I can't imagine. Why is Demetrius walking up? Why is he even here? And she peeps out of the front window, and she says, "I don't recognize him. I need to keep an eye out, because I've got to make sure, you know, I keep an eye out for all the people around here in the neighborhood." And aside from me freaking out from the fact that, because mind you, all this time we're thinking that she knows who he is because she claims that she's seen this, he comes walking up the street, and I'm going down in the chair like, oh my goodness, like, what is about to happen? And then she says, "I don't recognize him." And I'm looking at this woman, and I didn't say anything to her. Like, I didn't challenge her or anything, but I was speechless. I just couldn't. I mean, and it just rolled off her tongue. Like, it was clear as day that she did not know this man. She had never seen him before. And it was the absolute list. It was so crazy. It was absolutely crazy. But
did you ever tell her?
That was a day. No. No. That was a day, because it's like,
I don't know if you call that an aha moment, but it's one of these surreal moments.
Right,
that
yeah.
For some reason, these cases,
eyewitness testimony is not reliable.
Exactly.
And so I think that's a prime example. Besides eyewitness testimony, what do you think are the reasons that your clients get convicted?
Besides mistaken eyewitness testimony?
Mm-hmm.
Poor forensic evidence, running the gamut from just flat out incompetence in the way the testing was done. And more typically, it's been forensic analysts misrepresenting the meaning of test results to make them appear far more incriminating than in fact they are. A sort of reverence for and reliance on certain so-called forensic science disciplines that are really not scientific at all. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of categories of evidence, that's a big part of it. But that's not all of it. There's also a role of informants. They're basically unregulated marketplace of criminals who trade off information. And it's visible in the quintessential, you know, jailhouse snitch situation where someone actually comes in and testifies and says, you know, so-and-so, you know, bumped into me in the lunch line and confessed to the murder, that sort of thing. But there's a whole layer of operation of this that's not visible to the public at all. And it involves people who, you know, implicate other people because they have their own agenda, whether it's to shift attention from their involvement or, you know, because they have some vendetta or they've got some motive. And, you know, all it really takes is an informant to go and say, you know, X did something or other, X gets put in a photo array, and X then gets identified, and off we go. I'm speaking now in terms of categories of evidence. So we've got problems with forensic science evidence, some of which is really not science. Sometimes it is grounded in science, but it's misinterpreted, or it's presented as more definitive than in fact it is. We have mistaken eyewitness testimony in Maryland, like I think pretty much every other state. One eyewitness is sufficient to sustain any kind of conviction, and there's no need to have any corroboration. And we know there's all sorts of problems associated with the reliability of that type of evidence. So, and then you add into the mix informants who can have a, shall we say, deleterious effect on the truth-seeking process. And then we just have what I call structural breakdowns, where information that's supposed to get turned over before the trial to the defense that is exculpatory doesn't get turned over. And I see that with quite a bit of frequency in the cases that I handle. So you have that problem. You have a problem with the adequacy of both paid and assigned counsel. In the public sector, you typically have under-resourced, overworked defenders who don't have sufficient resources and time to dedicate to the cases. But I see a lot of very bad things going on even, and I think it's really important to say this because there's no question there is a crisis in this country for indigent defense funding. But what I think people don't always appreciate is if you don't have a lot of money to secure a very, very good criminal defense lawyer who's going to have the funds to conduct an investigation and to retain experts, you may not get very good representation. And to the extent that people sometimes just, I used to get this all the time when I was a public defender. I remember once walking out of the courtroom after my client had been acquitted of an armed robbery, and he said, you're pretty good. You should go to law school. And I said, what makes you think I didn't go to law school? Well, you're a public defender. So
that's my intro. That's my opening quote right there.
You know, it's
a lot of people don't think public defenders are lawyers.
And that, you know, that is a terrible disservice to many public defenders who are incredible lawyers working under incredibly difficult circumstances, trying day in and day out to do their best. So I feel it's important to put it out there that it's not all, by any stretch of the imagination, poor lawyering on the part of public defenders. We just see a lot of poor lawyering, period. I say poor lawyer, I mean poor lawyering on the part of the prosecution is not, it's not only poor, it's potentially unethical if they're aware of it. The prosecutor may not be aware of it if the exculpatory information is kept from them, which sometimes it is. Mm-hmm. The police department either intentionally or negligently doesn't provide it, and then they don't provide it because they don't know that it exists. But, you know, prosecutors who become overzealous to the point of just becoming blind to any objective assessment of the evidence because they just develop this kind of God complex or you know, some sort of personal hatred for the defendant that just really impacts their professional judgment or their ability to be objective, that's a problem. So, you know, there's bad lawyering is a big problem. And then, you know, bad judging, there's that problem too. Judges not functioning as neutral arbiters, but really functioning as a kind of adjunct arm of the prosecution and ruling in ways that are really very unfair to defendants. So there's a lot of problems.
What do your clients look like? Like, are they minorities? Are they women? Are they men? Or is it a mix?
They're overwhelmingly male, and I would say they are predominantly Black. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Okay, what else should I have asked? What's something that I'm forgetting to ask?
I think that a lot of more attention needs to be given to the care that exonerees need after they are released. There aren't the same mechanisms in place to make sure they have adequate resources as if they were being released on, say, parole or probation, where they actually had, you know, to report to a specific person, or if they were going, you know, to a halfway house or something like that.
They get nothing.
Yeah. So when you have no notice that your client is being released, it is essentially them being in prison for X number of years and then walking out of a courthouse, and you don't know what their family resources may be, if they have any family left, or, you know, even if...
Most of the time they don't even have identification,
yeah,
so you can't get anything.
Right.
You can't get medical benefits. You can't get... It's just unbelievable. I mean, the amount of time we've spent just trying to help our clients get a state ID so they can get medical care,
right.
It's pretty mind-boggling.
And another thing, and I don't know how often it happens, but I have heard of it happening, not even for guys that were exonerated, but just for people that have done extensive prison time, identity theft.
I never thought about that.
If you're being released and, you know, you have no idea who has been using your name or your social security.
Our client, Demetrius Smith, when he finally got out, he was working and he called me to say that money was being deducted from his paycheck by the Texas Department of Child Support Enforcement. He said, I've never been in Texas in my entire life. He did not have a child in Texas, but somebody had that name and that social security number, and I cannot even describe to you what was involved in trying to get that undone.
And then when you go to the Department of Social Services or was it Vital Records to try to get your birth certificate or other information,
they say, well, you have to have ID.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, how do I get the ID? I mean, it's just crazy.
Yes. The mental health issues that they have to deal with afterwards. I think a lot of people automatically assume that you've been released, life should be good now. But if prison life has been your life for X amount of years, then it is going to take a while for you to adjust. It just doesn't happen overnight. So just a lot of collateral issues that come with post-release and exoneration that I don't think get a lot of attention, but they're...
But on the mental health counseling piece of this, it's, I mean, aside from the issue of, you know, insurance and so forth and, you know, payments, you also have to really be careful that you get the right provider because, you know, not every mental health care provider is sensitive to the specific mm-hmm. issues associated, number one, with long-term incarceration, and then two, with long-term incarceration for something that you didn't do. Right. And all of the things that can accompany that, particularly if it was a really awful crime where you may have been subject to really serious mistreatment within the prison from other inmates, you know, if you were labeled a child killer mm-hmm. or, you know, something like that. So it's not, you know, it's not just a matter of opening up the yellow pages and finding, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. I went to therapy
school. Susie psychologist.
I went to therapy school and we never learned about this kind of treatment.
Yeah. I mean, there are very, I wasn't trained in it either. I just have learned over the years after dealing with many exonerees, I had to learn things like be very careful in the way that you touch them or approach them. Don't, you know, come up from behind. It, these are all things, that these are all adaptations to prison. I mean, I've gone to a restaurant with clients and they're very particular about where they sit so they can get out, you know, because prison is such a dangerous place. And it's just, I mean, they're fairly simple and once you understand, you can check yourself, but it's not necessarily obvious to people.
I talked to one man who said that when he got home, all he wanted to do was go to the fridge because he had missed that freedom so much to go get something out of the mm-hmm. fridge whenever he wanted to. It was, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm mad that my rental car doesn't have cruise control. I go to the fridge for 20 years.
Right.
So
the other thing a lot of our clients struggle with, and, you know, I have one female client right now, but all my exonerated clients have been male, and I don't know whether this has something to do with it, but almost invariably, with a few exceptions, but typically they're very resistant to the suggestion that they might need therapy. And, you know, what they just needed was somebody to finally understand they hadn't committed a crime, and, you know, they'd get on with their lives, and it almost follows a pretty predictable pattern for about 6 months or a year. They're, you know, they're enjoying the reality of their freedom, and then around about a year, maybe a little earlier, they start realizing that they have issues sleeping, or they have this anger they don't understand that's, you know, that they recognize is irrational and out of proportion, and it's almost like clockwork. And I start, they call and they say, you know, you were right. Maybe I need to talk to somebody.
There's so much stigma with that.
Yes. You know, there's sometimes stigma within their own communities or their own families. Sometimes I think it's this kind of macho belief that what are they not weak for? I'm not weak. I can do this. But some of it, I think also, especially if it's an exoneration that garners a lot of publicity, that adds a whole other element to this, which is, creates a whole other set of issues associated with media attention, because unfortunately what sometimes happens is that there's negative fallout from that, and, you know, people start emerging because they incorrectly assume that this person is going to be subject to some windfall award, and or they just like being part of this media event. And it's very strange to go from, you know, being this anonymous, pretty much neglected person sitting in a prison cell to all of a sudden, you know, you've got cameras in your face and reporters chasing you around and wanting to talk to you. And then after you go through that, sometimes that goes on for days or weeks, and then that's the end of that. And nobody's really paying any attention to how you're doing. As I've even had reporters say to me, like, oh, is this just another exoneration story? I mean, you know, give me something that's really special about this one. Mm. So I don't know whether, I mean, that's sort of
sick.
Strange that I suppose in a way that's the innocence movement's being a victim of their own success.
Until next time, I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. A special thanks to our sponsors, Talkspace, Spring, and Framebridge, for sponsoring today's episode. Remember, If you can't financially support our sponsors, you can still help by giving them a shout out on social media. Visit our website, www.actualinpod.com, to see our calendar, ways to support the show, and pictures of the team. The Actual Innocence podcast is produced and hosted by me, and I get help from the most amazing volunteer team ever, Megan, Casey, and Sarah. We are also so appreciative of our transcription team, Tori and Jane. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks for listening.
Kill Kiao Gove.
No, sir, I didn't kill Kiao Gove.
Mrs. Kiao Gove was in the prime of her life in 1991. At 53 years old, Kiao was a beloved wife and a mother to her 18-year-old son, Kirby, who was about to enter college. But early one Thursday morning, tragedy struck. On July 25th, 1991, Kiao Gove was brutally murdered. Kiao was stabbed over a dozen times. A neighbor, alerted by his barking dogs, discovered Kiao covered in blood and gasping for breath. He covered her with a blanket while he waited for the police. For over 3 years, the crime went unsolved. Until family drama led to the arrest of an unlikely suspect.
Me and Troy, my brother, the one that put me here, him and I were hanging out.
It's basically, my father told me to stay out of it.
For 23 years, Jesse Eldridge has been living behind bars for a crime that he did not commit. In existence, without hope. Until now. Jesse's case has been picked up by the Innocence Project of Texas, and they've asked for our help. We will be reinvestigating the case through crowdsourcing, in real time, together.
I'm a very tired man. Let me tell you, buddy. I am very tired. I would just like to live my life. I would just like to be able to live my life. As simple as that. I'd like to be able to hold my grandson. I'd like to be able to hold my wife without some guard looking over my shoulder.